Welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And we're going to talk about summer blockbuster movies and some that weren't so blockbuster. Where should we start, Mike, with the lineup?
Well, let's start off financially, because that's the boring stuff, if you will. We'll get it out of the way. But it's actually really significant in terms of summertime, of course, is the biggest season, though that's not always the case now. I mean, now big films release throughout the year, and so it's not as categorical as it used to be. But still, the summertime, you expect the blockbusters, the big sequels, and all that. The overall box office for the United States and Canada was $4.32 billion, which is still a lot of money. So I wouldn't start crying and, you know, despairing that people aren't going to the movies. However, it marks a 5% decline in attendance from the summer before. And there are some worrying signs there. Now, for me, and this is where I get on a hobby horse, what's been happening for quite a few years now, but really pronounced the last few years, is there are the absolute blockbusters, huge amounts of money. But then suddenly from there, what used to be the solid middle is kind of dropped out. And then, you know, that hurts there. Secondly, there are what had been expected to be big blockbusters, but they underperformed. And so that also tends to bring it down. But what's actually worrisome here is that some of the smaller budget films, indie films, art films, and so on, actually didn't do all that well. And that actually was kind of surprising for me. But I noticed it when I'd be at the theater and would end up having what amounted to a private screening. Nobody else went to that show with me. And so it's interesting to then note those changes in the marketplace. One of the most significant facts, and I'll leave off with statistics at this point, but one of them is that of all the summer films, all the summer box office, you know, you then look at how the studios divided up. And we all know that Disney is Disney's familiar with elephants, certainly, but it's the big one in the room. But what's interesting there is that Disney took in 51% of all the summer box office. That's enormous for one studio to dominate that way. And very quickly, before I hand off again, that came primarily from three Disney films, which we will be talking about: Aladdin, Toy Story 4, and The Lion King. And The Lion King, incidentally, was the box office champ for the summer. I'll sneak in one more statistic. Domestically, $523 million, easily the number one film in North America. Then an additional $1 billion overseas. That's a reminder that increasingly the market is, yeah, still in this country, but, you know, China's the number two film market. And then once you go around the rest of the world, a lot of films make a lot more of their money at this point overseas and not in the States.
Well, to talk a little bit about theater attendance, your local theater is an art theater. And the two closest to me are just, you know, regular multiplexes. And I've noticed that, you know, MoviePass, you know, came along and then kind of crashed and burned. But both of the theaters near me have deals where you sign up and you can see, you know, an unlimited amount of movies. And I've noticed that that brings in a lot more people. But they're not young people. Throughout the summer, it was never filled with young people. It was older folks.
People, you know, who used to clip coupons back in the day. Now, MoviePass is an interesting story, and you knew it firsthand. I knew it secondhand to observe it. It was offering such a great deal, it was too good to be true. And indeed, the warning signs were there from the start. You mean for $10 a month, I can see whatever I want? Well, that wasn't going to last. They burned through the cash so quickly that then they restructured it. And then when they restructured it, it became so Byzantine. Well, yes, you can see this one, but not that one. Or on this day of the week, but not that day. And it got so complicated the way that people started to think about bait and switch. And there were lawsuits, actually, people saying that, you know, the MoviePass was playing fast and loose that way. Just last week, MoviePass officially went out of business. They finally pulled the plug on the whole company. But see, you know, on a more general level, that was an extreme example of all the strategies that theaters are trying to adapt to get people in. But where it's an uncomfortable fix is the theater chains themselves initially had a very wary, uncomfortable relationship with MoviePass. Mm-hmm. They weren't crazy about it, actually. It wasn't something they asked for. They now are setting up their equivalents. And I know, like, for your neighborhood theater, something like AMC at Columbia, mm-hmm. they do offer deals like that. And when I see people taking advantage of it, it's an older demographic, to put it bluntly. And that's fine. I mean, actually, anyone coming through the door that way. But I think they're frankly still looking for the formula that works. Related to all of this is that because movie going, overall attendance has been down, the theater chains are trying everything they can think of to get people out of the living room and back to the theaters. That's why, as they retrofit theaters, they have fewer seats, more comfortable seats, all sorts of, you know, the full menu in the theater if you want it. And I know I go to the Cine Bistro at the Rotunda just to see movies. I go to dinner elsewhere, but that I'm the only one not eating there. But increasingly, it becomes an expensive sort of boutique operation. Now, you used to have the art houses and the indie circuit where they might cater to you that way. And now the mainstream theater chains are essentially doing the same thing. Ticket prices are high. People are getting assigned seats in the theater, which to me seems silly when I'm the only person in the theater, but I have my own seat that's been assigned to me. I don't know what would happen if I moved down a row. Would they throw me out? But the fact that you have that menu service and all that, they are acknowledging the fact that they have a smaller audience, which for various reasons is willing to pay a little bit more for the experience. It becomes a night out, a special occasion sort of thing like that. We'll see how that plays out. I'd much rather a world in which you have a lot of people going to the theater and the seats filled as opposed to the smaller group. If it gets much smaller, just come to my living room.
We'll be publishing your address at the end of this broadcast. I think the upside, though, is that that means for people who are really interested in film that they'll try films they wouldn't ordinarily go see because it's basically free.
Well,
you know, they've paid the subscription, so now they're going to try these indie movies. So if they can just get into the theater, they've got a much better chance now of being seen.
Well, we'll see the extent to which they try them. See, one of the things with MoviePass was they took a gamble in various ways. Part of the gamble was if people were paying only $10 a month initially, their thinking, and there's some logic to this, but their thinking was, well, a lot of people sign up for things, but then they don't go, and we'll make money that way. It's almost like if on your New Year's resolution is go to the gym, and you promise you're going to go a few days a week, blah, 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 but then by the end of January, you're only going once a week, and then once a month, and so on. That's where they start to make money off of you. And that was the thinking. Now, to support your case, with MoviePass, people were using it more often than was anticipated by the MoviePass executives, and they were losing more and more money with each transaction. So I'm hoping what you're saying is the case. I have no way of gauging at this point, really, as to whether, like with AMC and the others, is it cost-effective? I'm assuming it is. They give it a lot of promotion. I know every time I go up to the box office, they try to recruit me. They try to sign me up. And I've resisted for various reasons, but they certainly give it the marketing push. And I do see people, that older demographic, using it. For whatever reason, I don't see a younger demographic using it. And this is purely anecdotal. I don't have any data on this. But what's your sense of that?
I think that I'm surrounded by older folks when I'm in the theater.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm happy to see that they're trying movies. And I'm seeing movies that I don't know that I'd be happy to pay top dollar for. But while we're on the topic of top dollar, what's your top pick for the summer movie in the theater?
Well, I'll break it out this way. We should talk about the big box office films, what we liked and didn't like. But, you know, with my taste, usually the films I like best are the ones that cost $1.98 and make $1.98.
Well, let's hear about those.
You want to stick with big box office first, just because that's in terms of what people actually went to see.
All right. So what of the three big Disney films, which one did you think was the best?
I wasn't crazy about any of them, actually, and I actually wanted to ask you about this. I oftentimes have this theory, and maybe it's mean-spirited on my part, but I always refer to what I call unnecessary films. Like there's some films that are good, and some are bad, and some are just unnecessary, and maybe good in certain ways. And I thought The Lion King was unnecessary.
Me too.
And, well, why don't you pick up on this? Because, I mean, I'll go on a rant and we'll have a 45-minute episode otherwise.
To me, here's the difference between the remake of Aladdin and The Lion King. Because I loved Aladdin. Aladdin I saw in 3D. And what was fun about it was the real sense of three-dimensionality they had with the magic carpet ride. And the magic carpet was a great character. But while they were shooting those scenes where you're going through the alleyways and stuff, it felt like you were really on that magic carpet. It was really cool. Plus, you knew all the songs. And the take that Will Smith did on Robin Williams' character was really very nuanced. He was very likable. You remembered Robin Williams, and yet he didn't completely take over the movie.
Okay, I saw Aladdin flat. And maybe that's why I had a flatter response. But, you know, my feeling there was just I didn't feel the need for it necessarily. And yet I'll acknowledge the point you're making that it has its own identity that way. What kept me with it, frankly, and this sounds like a backhanded compliment, but what kept me with it was simply so much happens one thing after another that I wasn't bored by it. And it does have a certain sense of momentum there with character and storyline. Whereas with The Lion King, I really just felt like, you know, the original one works really well on its own terms. This one, okay, you know, they're saying that it's a different experience, but what do you think there? And by way of animation and so on, you know, is it animated? Is it live action? Is it in some category in between?
It doesn't add anything. You know, like when they redid The Jungle Book, you know, they went from, you know, a cartoon to real people and animatronic things and CGI. And that was a different experience because you really felt like it was a different movie, even though you knew the story.
But this gets into a philosophical question. When I was watching this most recent Lion King, and maybe as an academic, I worry too much about categories, but sort of which box to put it in. You know, I'm getting at, and you've taught courses on animation. Let me defer to you on this in terms of, well, you know, to what extent do you think of it as animation? To what extent as live action? What's your take on this?
Well, you know, really everything that's moving is animated. So
no, I know that. I know that. I was the only thing not animated. I was just sitting there. but joking aside, I wanted to really ask your take on that as to, well, what is this creature, this lion?
See, I think they didn't need to. I didn't find it any more realistic than
that's
I found
what I'm getting
the,
at.
That's animation.
That's
the
what I'm getting
drawn
at.
Drawn one, yeah.
That's what I'm getting at. And so then beyond that, once we cut through all that, and I
then
agree
I did. There was nothing. There's
no
nothing
there. There's no there. It's the same storyline and the music we know and so on. And you can you know, if you look for it, you can find minor differences here and there, but it's essentially the same thing. And that's where I start to turn against the film. And all I can think about at that point, since I mentioned Disney, and that's why I mentioned Disney at the outset, is it's a cash machine. Mm-hmm. You're all the ways in which when you have the copyright, when you have the franchise, you can cash in. And we've all been in situations where we didn't want to feel like somebody was reaching into the pocket that way. And I sort of felt that way, that I'm giving Disney my money and they have enough already, thank you. And I didn't feel the need for that. And yet it was absolutely the box office champ. It was one of those films that opened big and then just kept playing and still is playing. People still go, it's a safe choice that way. And I'm thinking, frankly, if I had small kids who would have been too young to know the original one, although from a toddler age, they can always watch that, that it would be a good way to introduce them, et cetera, et cetera. But as a veteran of Disney films, having seen the original one, I didn't feel the need for this remake at all.
What about Toy Story 4?
I was never, I'm in a minority here. I was never really a fan of the franchise, but I think at this point it's sort of played out. I don't know what else to do with it or where else to go. And for me, it's, you know, because I see all these films when they come out and they help me with my math because this is number four. And particularly when they have Roman numerals, you know, I know the Super Bowl and I know franchise filmmaking with Roman numerals. It's a good way to learn those, actually. With Toy Story 4, my feeling was just they've kind of played out. And they're at the point now where, you know, the children within the story, the characters, they're going to grow up, blah, blah, blah. And it keeps going that way, which I know from a creative standpoint, from a scripting standpoint, it justifies further installments, but I have this terrifying vision. It'll just be like, you know, generation to generation now. And now that you're growing up and have your toy chest, what you find in there.
Well, I thought it was a charming way to close out the main characters, so you know they're not coming back.
Well, that actually, again, joking aside, I did appreciate that.
But you know what was a funnier animation was the Lego movie. The second part, that was hysterically funny. And that was one that I saw in the theater all by myself because I waited almost till it was gone. And again, saw it in 3D and just laughed all to myself in an empty theater.
See, I saw it the opening weekend and it really helped to have parents with young children. And usually under other circumstances, particularly if you're watching a really serious film, you don't want some kids shouting, right? But this is a case where you want that. You want that feedback and all because sometimes for me, it not only enhances the experience, sometimes it's better than what's happening on screen. The stuff the kids will shout out is more entertaining sometimes.
But there were so many jokes really lobbed at the adults.
Well, you know why that is, really, and this is a general case, and you're well aware of it, is that we used to have animated films like that, and people would talk, sometimes in a pejorative sense, well, it's family fare, it's for parents with young kids, and as an adult, you wouldn't be caught dead, blah, blah, blah. But what's happened, of course, is as those films became big box office, they are really being pitched at not just parents with kids, but at adult viewers, at, you know, mature people on a date of their own, and a lot of the jokes, you know, frankly would not register with a really small kid. It's a you know, a boomer reference or something. It's a, you know, a name or a song or something that registers with people who've been on the planet for a while and would sail past the kids. One reason why that's very safe is that the parents appreciate it, they get it. And if the kid doesn't get it, either the parent can look on it as a teachable moment or just let it fly by because these films are so fast-paced, you're on to the next joke. You know, it's a Tom and Jerry kind of scenario, right? If you miss one joke or it falls flat or whatever, so what? You know, a minute later, you've got something else.
Did you see anything this summer you thought was Oscar-worthy?
Well, that's an actually great question. The short answer is no. The longer answer is, well, certainly with the films we've been talking about so far in technical categories, yeah, mm-hmm. they've got the market there. In terms of films that otherwise are likely to get nominations, bear in mind, of course, Avengers carried over well into the summer. So that's going to be, and that's the biggest film of the year. So we can consider it a summer film in some ways. You know, and you're talking about, you know, $2.8 billion worldwide. I mean, it's a record holder. But back to your question, the films like Rocket Man certainly will get like an acting categories mm-hmm. and direction and scripting. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood mm-hmm. certainly will get nominations that way. Those are ones that immediately come to mind. The more open question is, you know, when you get Spider-Man type films, when Academy Award nominations go out, how big a field it is. In other words, like some years they're really generous and you find those superhero movies are getting a lot of nominations. Other years, for whatever reason, not as many. And so that's sort of an unknown at this point.
A couple of late entries into the summer that I think had some Oscar caliber possibilities was The Goldfinch, Roger Deakins, for the amazing cinematography.
And it's the only thing I liked about it.
After the Wedding, which I don't think was a very successful film, but I think both Michelle Williams and Julianne Moore could be nominated.
Well, I agree and I disagree. With After the Wedding, of course, as a remake, did we need that as a remake?
We did not.
Not necessarily, but on its own terms, it's not a particularly notable film. Both those actresses give really fine performances. But you know what? The film itself is a small film that didn't open particularly well critically or commercially. It's going to pass from the scene pretty quickly. So in terms of Oscar nominations, by later this year, it will be an afterthought for people. Both those actors have done such good work in so many films. I don't think they'll get the nod here, but you're absolutely right, like taken on its own terms. If you sit and watch After the Wedding and you think about those two performances, mm-hmm. yes, I would say those are really good, but pragmatically speaking, I think they'll be forgotten.
I also really like Cate Blanchett in Where Did You Go, Bernadette?
Yeah, she's strong in it. I know, but that's another film where like where'd the film go? I mean, it doesn't have enough lasting power, and just like the news cycle so quickly nowadays, the theatrical cycle can be just as fast, and films come and go pretty quickly. And that's a film that just didn't quite register fully.
There's always one obscure movie, though. You know, no one saw it, but people who do talk about that one performance. So tell me what went wrong for you in The Goldfinch? Did you read the book, for starters?
Well, ordinarily, I'm a big advocate for novels into film. But by way of full disclosure, I have not read the Donna Tartt novels. So I have that, in a sense, as a disadvantage. But that's where I always fall back on saying, well, the film has to stand on its own merits. I always say that when I haven't read the book, okay? In this case, you know, again, joking aside, I wish I had read the book, because with the way the film is structured, there's so much jumping around in chronology and between characters. I was able to piece it together, but it took a little bit of effort there to make sense of all that. I agree with you that the cinematography is quite beautiful. I don't think the film quite registers at all in terms of character depth, character psychology, or empathy for that matter. I felt at an emotional distance. I felt a really cold response to what I was seeing. And what really bothered me after a while, and in fact, to reinforce my opinion, I'll use some box office. The movie absolutely bombed at the box office. It took in a little over $2 million its first weekend. So presumably everyone who went to see it had read the novel, but nobody else, except me. But no, the film is 2.5 hours long. Mm-hmm. And with a case like that, where you feel like emotionally detached, you're not really going with it, it's a long sit. It's a long haul.
See, I didn't even notice the time elapsing. And in fact, after the movie was over, nobody moved. They sat through the
credits. No, they were comatose. Of course they didn't move.
I really liked seeing Ansel Elgort from Baby Driver. In fact, I sort of, as soon as I recognized him, I ascribed all the things from that character in Baby Driver to his character in The Goldfinch. So I immediately connected with him and believed his, you know, portrayal. I bought in completely.
It has, on paper, it has a strong cast. Certainly a lot of names we recognize. And that kept my interest to some extent, just to see actors I care about going through the motions there. But I really feel like it's a picture where it doesn't quite gel, you know, emotionally. And as an adaptation, It really is a mess at times in terms of some of the jumps seem so arbitrary. And I'm speaking only as a moviegoer. I don't know how the narrative is handled in the novel. Does it jump around that much in the novel?
Oh, I didn't read the novel either.
Oh, well.
No, I took
well,
it on
so much
completely.
For my guilt trip.
But I wasn't
I was trying
feel
to draw
guilty.
You out. I was going to say, how about in chapter 3? But this is where if we had callers calling into something like this, they would take us to task. But I honestly did wonder about that. And I should have read the book because I know it was well regarded. Won the Pulitzer Prize and all that. But what catches me off guard a bit is that the film is so jittery. It jumps around so much.
See, I think it has a dreamlike quality that reminds me of like Hugo.
Yeah, of like falling asleep.
But it's like, I don't know, it's like a fairy tale.
Well, see, that's one reason why I couldn't quite get a handle on it, because it does have a fable quality to
yes.
it.
Yes. You know, it's almost like the poor little match girl even.
But yeah, but it is supposedly still tethered to some New York real estate and elsewhere that we'd recognize. And to me, it was ultimately one of those in-between, not quite enough of this or of that. And a lot of the jumps, a lot of that just seemed arbitrary to me after a while, and then poorly explained. So in terms of characters, like how did these two meet and character motivation? Yeah, I could piece it together, but it was work. And again, as I said a moment ago, that emotional distance I felt. His performance in The Lead is technically competent. It's fine. But I never felt empathy, if you will. I never cared for the character.
Now, how about, speaking of Oscar nominations, do you think there's a chance for Jennifer Lopez in Hustlers?
No, it's more than a chance. She's got a lock on this for a few reasons. She's had a long career. She's liked in the industry. She's done good work. She hasn't always been taken as seriously as she should be as an actor. And we can speculate about that at length. But the fact of the matter is the film Hustlers opened really well at the box office. Everyone who did not go to see The Goldfinch went to see that.
I saw a doubleheader.
For some reason, they preferred strippers to this literary material. But,
I saw them both
in the same weekend. But back to your Jennifer Lopez, the Carpetbagger column in the New York Times already says she'll have an Oscar nomination here. I agree very strongly, and she's really enjoyable in this film, and not just for the obvious reasons. I mean, she's really, really. I don't like the
she's
film.
She's believable.
I don't like the film at all, but I do like her performance in it quite a bit. So yes, I think she's going to be nominated for Best Actress.
That's exactly what my summation of that movie. I did not like the movie. Although I did think it really did show you how trapped people in that world are. That was
yeah. But how long do you want to be trapped in that world?
Yeah. By the time you're ready to get out, no, you're realizing
you know what?
There
are a lot of scenes where you see them at work. I'll keep it PG rated. Well, you see them at work, mm-hmm. and when you see a few scenes like that, yeah, it's eye candy. However you want to, whatever you make of it in an ethical sense, you keep watching, right?
Right.
You might say that's disgusting, and then you say, well, let me see another.
Right.
How disgusting!
Is this as disgusting as I thought it was?
Yeah. So anyway, it has that. But you know what? And joking aside here, after four or five scenes like that, it's more the same. It's pandering, basically. And where it falls short is in so many areas. Let me tick off, because I got ticked off. I'll tick off a few of them. Okay, these are women who we learn so little about their backgrounds, and particularly in terms of with men, where divorced or separated or whatever, glimmers, just little quick glimpses. And a few of them have children. Now, an odd thing, and we'll have to talk about biology here, these are single mothers who only give birth to daughters. And I don't know why this is, but it's very, very, but is the film feminist? This is what it comes down to. Because, okay, they've got daughters. Now, here's one thing, and it really irritated me. At least one of those daughters is of an age, and I don't know her exact age, she's of an age where you learn about the world and your parents mm-hmm. and this and that. Does she know what mommy does for a living? And if so, how is that explained, and how does she feel about it? It's totally not dealt with. This is where there's so many ethical shortcomings. Here's the biggest ethical shortcoming. Their targets are Wall Street wolves, mm-hmm. and these guys are deserving. Yeah, I want them taken down. Take his credit card, max it out. But here's the problem, and it's really irritating. Okay, you're gonna take these guys out to the club, get their card, run up the tab, and so on. And when you see what sleazes they are, you don't have to be a quote unquote feminist to think, God, these guys are jerks. Take them for all they have. Okay. So they're able to do that, and you can still, I suppose, justify it. Okay, you can now make your rent. And in fact, it goes beyond that. You have enough money, cash in hand, and it's a cash business, cash in hand, that grandma can pay off her house.
Yes.
But then when it goes beyond that, you know what it is? The way they behave is just as despicable mm-hmm. in a lot of ways as what we're supposedly against with the Wall Street guys. In other words, the movie ultimately, in a very superficial way, celebrates materialism. Whether it's the Wall Street guys living it up or these women living it mm-hmm. up as part order their payback. And that's really irritating. The only thing that made me, well, I laughed a few times during the film. It's like laughing during Showgirls. You're going to laugh at a time, you know. But what only really made me laugh at the end, I read the end credits of a film, and not just to see who drove the honey wagon, you know. I read the end credits, and at the end of this film, there are two end credits, one almost next to the other. One is for what they call a pole trainer.
Oh.
And two lines under that, they credit somebody as a Wall Street consultant, which I thought was so funny. Somebody will say, well, yes, that's how we dress, that's how we talk, and so on. But to have the pole trainer, I wondered, like, you know, how much did that pole trainer get paid? And what was the work contract like as to what you do? But they did use the pole well.
Yeah.
And I'll let it go with that.
Well, it was actually both films, The Goldfinch and the Hustlers movie, both had the same number of people in it, so...
Now, very quickly, we've been talking about box office films, most of which perform well, things that were disappointing, and one reason why the overall summer box office went down. Godzilla, King of Monsters, for instance, this is where it's really a relative statement. Did it bomb? Well, it took in almost $400 million worldwide. You wouldn't call that a bomb, but relative to production costs and marketing, yes, it suffered. It didn't do well. Other things that really did bomb, you know, sequels to things like Men in Black, International, Shaft, and so on, that they were, it was assumed they would do well. For reasons that would take a while to talk through, these films underperformed. So that leaves us quickly with some of the small films. What did you like over the summer that was independent or foreign?
Well, you know, one movie I really liked more than I should have was Booksmart.
I liked it too.
You did?
I did.
I mean, part of it is just, it's, you know, Porky's with female characters. But once you get past that superficiality, because that's just the frame, I thought the interaction between the two women was really authentic. The two friends.
Yeah. You know what I like so much over the summer? This is a rolled out answer. There were some really small independent films that were documentaries, which I love, and they were biographical. And we had a spate of those, so many of them.
A whole spate?
Yes. And in fact, very quickly, Echo in the Canyon, Walking on Water, which is about, Walking on Water, Jay Myself, Toni Morrison, Pieces I Am, Pavarotti, David Crosby, Remember My Name, Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, Mike Wallace Is Here, Marion and Leonard, Words of Love, Linda Ronstadt, Sound of My Voice. I mean, easily,
and
it
honey.
Is a spate.
Honey?
Yeah. I mean, we had easily a half dozen or more films that were biographical, and that's really, really terrific that these were interesting films about you know, fascinating people. And so I just was mesmerized to have that assortment, a whole smorgasbord of all these films. And I like some more than others, but just really fascinating to immerse myself for 90 minutes in a biographical subject that way. And almost every week we'd have a film like that opening. Yeah.
Well, you know, there was also a spate of movies.
I have a copyright on that word, but I'll let it. You have
of
it.
Movies about musicians. So we had Blinded by the Light, and we had Yesterday, and Rocket Man. And of the three, I really liked Yesterday.
I liked it well enough. To me, it has that conceit where you just have to go with it. Mm-hmm. You know, somehow all the world has forgotten the Beatles, except. And if you don't totally go with that, it can be kind of arduous. And there were points where I just thought the logical side of me kept wondering and worrying over that. But on its own terms, it's enjoyable for sure. That was actually the sleeper hit of the summer. It only cost $26 million. It made $135 million. So, like, based, you know, from budget to profit, it's just about the most profitable film of the summer. Summer judged that way, you know, relative to production costs, and it just held on. It did really well at the box office, and it's just it's an enjoyable film. Sure.
It is. It's a fun movie. What else would you have said was you might not have seen it, but too bad you missed it in the movies.
Well, there are a few things, a really small film, and this is a documentary called Honeyland. It's about a...
That's what I was mentioning.
Yeah. I mean, this you know, ancient woman, she's not so ancient, actually, she looks ancient, and she's up in the mountains there, and she's keeping bees and so on, and it's such a modest, when I say modest, I simply mean, you know, focusing on her and just, you know, her family and friends in this isolated village, but it's just so lovingly observed, it's so beautifully made, and it's a tiny, you know, it goes beyond small, it's a tiny film, right, but that devotion, that documentary devotion to a subject, and I really liked it. I was really taken with it. Yeah, and so again, that film's not going to make much, but so what? The people who go to see it love it, and we can recommend that you search it out, and it is available or will be.
Anything not a documentary that came and went in the Charles real fast, and we should look for it on DVD?
Well, I had mixed feelings about The Farewell, but it's worth seeing, and that's one where it's been playing reasonably well in the art houses, but it's and likewise, Tel Aviv on Fire was not crazy about, but it's entertaining, and people might want to search it out on their own.
That wraps up this week of At the Movies with Mike and Marie. So join us next time.
All right, see you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.